If you're looking for fundraising wisdom, 20 time-tested truths to fund evangelism. Say that five times fast. I wrote that really cool title. Wow. My name is John Ogle. I'm the Vice President of Development with the Luis Palau Association. And in February, I passed the 25-year mark in this same role. I have had zero career advancement. I have been the Vice President of Development for 25-plus years. I haven't gone anywhere. But when we launched the Next Generation Alliance back in, I think it was 1997 or 8, we as a ministry, the Palau Association, just had a heart to take anything that we've learned over our years of doing this and to try to just give it out to other gifted evangelists, people that were called to proclaim the good news of Jesus, with the hope that they could maybe not have to make some of the same mistakes that we've made, and to benefit from some of the wisdom and the insight that we've learned from working in the trenches. And that's the spirit of Next Generation Alliance. And so it's my hope and prayer that this session this morning, that some of these principles that I've learned and applied over my tenure in development, prior to coming to work with Palau, I worked with a mission agency called Bible Literature International for 8 years that provided scriptures to missionaries and mission strategies all over the world. And then my earliest days in ministry was with what used to be called Campus Crusade for Christ and is now called CRU. And I just got placed in their Office of Development. What is that? That's the fundraising dimension of CRU. And so I got my start there. So I've been doing this now since 1982, full time. And when I started at Palau, I was 33 years old, and I'm standing here at age 58, and I can't believe what happened. But my heart is to share things that you can go home and apply to your ministry. And so I'd like to just lead us in a word of prayer, and then we'll get into some of this content. Let's pray together. Father, we thank you for the gospel, for life in Jesus, and for the calling that you've put on our life to be your messengers to a world that is truly lost without Jesus. And Father, you know our heart, and you've put a call on our life, and you're giving us vision and resources, funds are just super critical to seeing this vision fulfilled. And so, Father, I just pray today that you would take something that's shared and make it something that we can apply to our calling and ministry. And Lord, we know you're our provider. And so we look to you to provide every dollar we need to fulfill the vision that you've called us to. But Lord, use this time to help us learn and grow in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.
So, yeah, it was kind of in my prayer, but what I've found many times in evangelism is we have a message, the gospel, we have methods, and we have messengers, but there's an M that's missing. It's money. And it's critical. And so we take it seriously at Palau. We joke about it a little bit. But in many cases, this is what's holding us back from fulfilling what God's called us to do fully. And so, again, it's my hope and prayer that I'll be able to share some things today. And I think this will be applicable to you if you've been doing ministry and fundraising for ministry for many, many, many years. This will be probably a reminder, and you'll just go, yeah, I've seen that to be true. And if you're new to ministry, And if you're new to fundraising, I think you're going to hear some things that are going to be new and that are going to help you in your calling and your work. So 20 proven principles to guide your development effort, and we're going to start with number one, and that's people give to people. Or I'm sorry, people need to give. We need to ask often. And I'm going to start with a scripture. This is something that is important that we understand, and you've probably heard this verse before, but this is Jesus speaking, and he says in Acts 20, verse 35, "In everything I showed you that by working hard in this manner, you must help the weak, and remember the words of the Lord Jesus that he himself said, 'It is more blessed to give than to receive.'" People need to give. This is how God made us. We are designed to give. There is a very famous play story that is shared at Christmas time. It's called A Christmas Carol, Charles Dickens. And there is a character in that called Scrooge. He's referred to as a miser. That is the same root as miserable. Okay? He didn't understand giving. We've all been designed to give, to have a part in meaningful things, to advance God's kingdom. We're designed to give. And the average American, at least, and maybe elsewhere in the world, is bombarded with messages every single day, very few of which are helping encourage them to invest their lives in things that matter for eternity. And so our job, one of our jobs, is to give an invitation for people to invest in things that are going to make an eternal difference. That's what happens when we ask people for financial support. And when we do that, that unlocks meaning and blessing in the lives of the people that are doing the giving. Fundraising, there's a lot of bad thinking about fundraising. This first point, that when we invite people to give, we're unlocking blessing in their life, is the most important one principle you've got to understand. It's the real secret to fundraising. When we're inviting people to give to God's kingdom, that's unlocking blessing to them. That is not an adversarial moment where we're trying to get someone to do something that they don't want to do. I don't know if you ever think about fundraising in that way, that you're kind of doing something to someone. Rather, you're unlocking an opportunity for them to get blessed. And so people need to give. We need to ask often. Second, people give to people justified by the cause. And my encouragement to you would be to focus on relationships. It all comes down to individual relationships. My wife Karen, who is here sitting against the wall, we both worked for Campus Crusade for Christ back in the day. And then I left to go serve with Bible Literature International, and we found love and got married, and she had raised her personal support at Campus Crusade, and then she came to work for, or came to be my wife, and I was working for Bible Literature International. What do you think happened to the financial support that was going to Campus Crusade for Christ? It went to Bible Literature International. Why? Because people give to people justified by the cause. Now, if I had worked for the American Atheist Association, that support wouldn't have migrated. Why? Because the donors could not relate to the cause. Okay? But people give to people justified by the cause. And in the ministry that I serve with and have for 25 years, it has a person's name and the name of the organization. the Luis Palau Association. And so this principle of people give to people justified by the cause is amplified in an organization like this, where, you know, there's a classic photo. I don't have it to pop on the screen, but if you've ever seen any Luis Palau materials, you will be familiar with this picture of Luis's backside, okay? And he might be holding a Bible, and then there is a massive crowd, faces looking at the camera. That is the expression of people give to people justified by the cause, and it is God's hand is on that guy. And there's a lot of people that support the Palau ministry for that reason. Not all, and there's other things that you can do to build it, but I think in many cases when we're dealing with fundraising for evangelists, donors are basically saying, I believe God's hand is on X. And it's okay to focus on those kinds of relationships. People give to people justified by the cause. Number three, people give primarily for emotional reasons, but they justify their giving with logic. So the action item there would be to use language that appeals to emotion. I think sometimes we want to keep it very like heady, but fundraising is largely about emotion, okay? So that's why, you know, powerful stories, powerful videos, things that touch the heart often drive fundraising. I remember many years ago, this was during my time with Bible Literature International, and we went to call on a guy named Orville Marilat. Back in the probably late 80s, early 90s, Marilat Kitchen Cabinets was the number one kitchen cabinet in America. Orville Marilat, or, you know, kind of had this company. And he had a charitable foundation, and we went to visit with Mr. Marilat in his living room. And I was with another representative of the ministry, and we said, hey, Mr. Marilat, you know, we're just getting acquainted. It's like, how do you decide where you give? Which is a good question to ask people. They may have a real answer, or they may not really even know. But he paused for quite a bit of time, and he said, gut feel. Gut feel. This is a guy that was giving millions of dollars away. Giving is mostly emotional, but people justify their giving with logic. I've seen people logic their way out of gifts, but much of giving is emotional. And so for us who are seeking to engage people financially in our ministry, a lot of the power comes from our ability to transfer our emotion to others. So we're excited about seeing people go from death to life. We're excited about the strategies that God's given us to. We've got stories. We need to bring that kind of passion and emotion to the conversations we have with donors. And God uses that. Number four, people like to give what they are expected to give. I can remember getting, like, it was really took me off guard, which is why I remember this so much, but very intense businessman in Southern California, a publisher. And he was German. I don't know if that means anything, but he was just kind of like, and I sat down with him, and like within like a minute or two, he said, what do you want? I think I was really ready. I knew whenever I go see this guy, I need to be ready to say what I wanted. And I stumbled around and I came up with something, and he wrote me like a large check before I left the office. So there was a guy that like people want to know what they're expected to give. And so he wanted me to tell him what our expectations was. That's hard to do a little bit when you're getting acquainted with someone. But people like to know what they're expected to give. One of the things that we do from time to time at Palau on larger projects is we break them down into what we call a table of gifts. And I'm sure you've seen these before, but it's kind of like a donor pyramid. And let's say it's a $1 million project, and you can just scale it, you know, down or up. But like on a $1 million project, you might have like one gift at $100,000, two gifts at $50,000, four gifts at $25,000, and just kind of cascade down with different amounts. And having a table of gifts is one way to help donors kind of figure out like where they might want to come in. In fact, one of the ways that we'll use it, we'll break that table of gifts. And if you want to email me, and my email address is on the outline, I will email you one of these tables of gifts so you can just see an example from LPA. But we'll kind of do like the first three levels will be like, you know, some name like platinum level. The next three levels might be the gold, and the next three levels would be silver. And we'll say, we're hoping you would consider a gift in, sometimes I'll just won't even say the word. If I'm meeting someone face to face, I'll just say, we were hoping you'd consider a gift in this level. Some of us aren't super gifted or experienced or comfortable asking people for specific amounts. We won't have a show of hands on that. And I hope you'll attend Ron Fry's session this afternoon, because the entire session is on kind of getting beyond what I think he calls like askophobia or something. Go to that. I really encourage you to go to that. But by using your finger on a level, you haven't had to say that word of $25,000. We were hoping you'd be consider a gift in the platinum level. But people want to know what they're expected to give. We had a situation recently at a Palau festival. It was kind of in the early lead up. It was about a year out, and we were having a kind of a fundraising reception where we were going to put the vision of the festival in front of a bunch of marketplace people. And there was a co-chair of the fundraising team. The two co-chairs were kind of helping with this event. And the guy that hosted it, though, was sort of a guy that didn't have an official position with the structure of the festival, but knew us really well and really had a vision for this thing. And the co-chairman, and he was sort of influential in recruiting this co-chairman of the fundraising team. And the guys told us, or told this guy that recruited him, like the level of support that he was going to give to the event, and it was going to be $10,000. And that was not a really significant gift in terms of this guy's capacity and in terms of the overall campaign budget, which was well over $1 million. And so this friend who recruited him and I, we were on a telephone call together, and I was so proud of this guy who's not on our staff, but he really went after this guy about lifting his sights and his giving level, and talked about a level much more significant. And that was like 3 days before the event, and then like a few hours before, he said, I've changed my mind and I'm giving 50. And so he didn't understand what the expectation was. This guy helped him understand what the expectation was, and he rose to the challenge. So people like to give what they're expected to give. Number five. Oh, so ask people to give specific amounts. People who participate in a ministry will give more to that ministry. And so look for ways to involve your people. We like to bring people to our festivals. One of the ones that kind of sticks in my mind was last summer, a little over 12 months ago, we had a festival in Eugene, Oregon, part of the Bible Belt, not really. And it was a one-day festival in the baseball stadium on the University of Oregon campus, and it was a glorious day. And we invited people to come join us, and we had, I don't know, 20 or 30 people that came. A lot of them were donors that traveled to just come and be a part of this. And so we will do a little very simple like counselor training. And there's usually a hospitality area at the festival, and there was, so we gave them access to that. And then when the invitation is given at our festivals, many times the place where there's the fewest number of counselors is in the very front of the platform. It's not like the old, you know, crusade days where we have this big open space and then people very organized fashion kind of come forward and stand at the front with a counselor. No, this is like just packed with people. You know, they want to get as close as possible to the stage and the music and all this stuff. And so it's hard to infiltrate that with counselors. And so we brought these partners of the ministry who had been trained to do the counseling. We got them the bright, ugly orange t-shirt. They put the t-shirt on, and we just positioned them right across the front of the stage. And we told them, don't look at Andrew when he gives the invitation. Look out this way, and you're looking at the faces of the people. And when Andrew gives the invitation, he's going to be asking people to raise their hand. And when they raise their hand, you find, you know, kind of lock in on that person. And then when he gives you the okay, you go have a chance to share and help people kind of confirm their decision to accept Jesus Christ and to pray for those people. Is that powerful donor dynamics? And I just loved kind of, there was a picture that was taken later, and it was like, wow, here's like, I don't know, like two dozen Luis Palau, you know, significant donors that are lined up across the front of that stage, all ministering and helping people come to know Jesus Christ. People that participate in a ministry will often give more to that ministry. So look for ways to involve people in your ministry. Okay, I've done 5 points. I have not had one question. I probably have about 45 minutes worth of stuff here. I'm going to keep trucking unless you guys ask questions, and we'll have kind of a question time at the very end, but I want to kind of leave it open, like if you have questions on these points as we go, let's talk about it. Here's one over here.
You talked about how people decide based on emotion instead of logic. So give me some examples of how you would take like a logic-based appeal and turn it into an emotional appeal.
So the question was, how do you take a, I'm going to say like a very strategic versus concrete kind of cause concept and make that emotional? I think it has to come down to the story. And so there's, no matter how complex or strategic the cause is, it's going to eventually touch an individual life. And so you've got to link the strategy to this change life. You've got to tell that story. And stories beat stats. Stats have their place and are important, but stories are the way to do that. So you just have to kind of link to the heart of people. And stories touch people's hearts. Yes, in the back.
So you talked about like being able to measure somebody according to what you think they can give. Like, where do you even get that information to begin with? Because like, how do you size someone up as far as the giving capacity? Are you looking at their cars they drive, or like, where do you, like, how do you start with that?
Yeah, good, great question. I'm glad this shows that you're thinking. Okay, good. How do you determine where to challenge someone as you're kind of building a relationship? And it is not an exact science. That's why the table of gifts is good, because it gives ranges and you're not having to kind of lock down on a single amount. If they have a giving history with your organization, then you know what their historical giving has been. That's one way to look. Second thing is actually very subjective. It is like the cars, the neighborhood, their profession. Those are some things where you can draw some sort of conclusions, but those can be deceiving. I remember one time I was with Luis, and he was speaking at Mariners Church in Newport Beach, California, which is like a very cool, big church in a very wealthy community. And so afterward, between services, Luis was signing books. And so this is like kind of a little secret technique, not very secret, but like the development guy, me, I would stand there kind of next to Luis during the book signing. And he would just sometimes ask people more about what they do or whatever, and then I would catch them as they come off the thing with the book in their hand, and I'd say, hey, we'd love to stay in touch with you. And so I got this guy's address from, you know, that process. And he lived in this, you know, super house like in Newport Coast, California. Very, you know, and Zillow. You know, Zillow.com? I mean, it's like super easy. You can do it in 10 seconds. You can know what the value of someone's house is. And so we started to invest in the relationship with this guy and started to invite him to come to some things and some stuff. And it was about 2 years in when I found out he rented the house. Okay, so I'm saying that this stuff is, it has its limits. He actually became a, you know, a decent sized donor, so it kind of worked out in that case. But, you know, none of this stuff is fail safe. The other thing is there are some people that would give to groups and organizations that actually publish their giving. A lot of colleges and universities publish their honor roll. There's this really cool, I'm going to give you a little insider strategy out there on how to get some inside info, and it's called Google. But Google the person. See if there's any history that might be public about the types of gifts that they've given to certain things. You might know their friend. Maybe their friend has done something in a fundraising sense with them that might be able to give you some insight into where this person is at. And then when all else fails, it's sort of like, Holy Spirit, guide me and see where it goes. So though it's not an exact science, what would happen if you asked for an amount larger than the person would be thinking about giving? What could happen?
They might know someone.
They could say no, and they might know someone. Yeah. They might be able to do it next year. They might say, I can't do that, but I'll do this. They may think, wow, this guy thinks I'm really worth something. That kind of feels good. That's possible. There's not a lot of downside for aiming high. Crazy high is not good. Okay? So this is where we have to use the Holy Spirit and just wisdom. But those are some like ways that you can begin to uncover like where someone might be at. And we've had tons and tons of surprises where people have... there was a... I'll save the story. You got a question here?
Yeah, you shared about the person who essentially should have been, had more capacity, we needed to ask more. I had somebody who, you know, pledged $10,000.
Okay.
I'm super early. I'm about to plant a church. We just kind of, he just believes in me. But I had like essentially no information, not real information to give him. And I didn't make an ask.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that his capacity would be greater.
Okay.
And so now I'm having a follow-up conversation with him. And so essentially it's like if you were coaching me.
Yeah.
And now I have to, I just got to follow up on a couple of things. What do you suggest I do?
Well, when did he make the $10,000 gift or commitment?
It was a pledge, I'd say, a month ago.
A month ago. Okay. Well.
And it was, it was like in a moment, just over dinner, because we're friends.
Yeah. How well have you thanked him?
I think I've done an okay job, not excellent.
Okay. Excellent thinking first. Yeah. Okay. And there's not a lot of time yet for him to see kind of the achievement of his first gift.
Yeah.
So that would be an important part in the process. But I think it would be good if you do have a face-to-face meeting with him is do an excellent job of thanking him for his part and then invite him to pray with you about the remaining need, which is, if he understands the remaining need, that might help him understand. It's like, wow, my gift was valued and there is a need for more. And you know, as you kind of build relationship and work through the process, then you need to be asking him for something larger, not on this first visit. And I have a case where my wife and I went to a major Christian college's fundraising event. And we were led to give a sizable gift to that major Christian college. I mean, it was big for us. And the representative of the ministry called me 4 or 5 days later, and I'm thinking, man, I'm going to get thanked. And she said, that was nice, but it's a 2-year campaign. Could you give that same amount again the next year? In fact, could you increase it by another 50%? 4 days later. That did not bless me. And that was it. That totally soured the gift I committed, which we did it, but I'm not giving a penny to that very fine Christian college. Why? Just didn't honor, you know, kind of the expectations that we had. So this stuff can get tricky. We better keep moving. Let's go to number 6. People like to feel they are a worthwhile member of a worthwhile group. Look for ways to create community among your donors. People do not want to be the sole major supporter to your initiative. That actually feels risky to them. And so if there are peers that they can see and sort of connect with and be a part of that are also stepping up at significant levels, that really assures donors. It gives them confidence to give and to give boldly because they see the quality of the other people that are involved. We do a major donor weekend multiple times a year. That's not going to be for everybody today in this room, but it might be. You might be ready for it. And you may be ready for it someday. But one of the beautiful things about that weekend is they're sitting around tables like this with other people that are smart, credible, godly people that are giving generously to this ministry. They like that too. They make friends. They make connections. We have a annual fundraising dinner here in Portland. We do a table host reception for everybody that hosts tables before the event. Well, they get to come and they kind of hang out with our leadership, and many times we'll have interesting speakers or musicians that are there, and they have an opportunity to kind of connect with those people, and they see their friends. That's cool. They want to be a worthwhile part of that. I'm one of Luis's team. You know, we don't give that like a unique name. Campus Crusade, back when I was working there, had the greatest donor group and name in the history of mankind. History's Handful. Bill Bright, this was when the Jesus film was taken off. It's Come See Me If You're Young, and I'll tell you what the Jesus film is, but it's powerful. But he believed that God had told him he was supposed to raise $1 billion. This was in 1977, $1 billion. And it was a very simple strategy, and I'll blow up the strategy in a little bit, but I'm going to find 1,000 people to each give me $1 million. And if you gave $1 million, you were part of history's handful. The name evokes so many powerful, you're a handful of people that are going to change history. And when I left in 1994, no, in 86, he had like well over 200 people that had done that. You know, I always call it, it was like a miserable failure, Bill. You only raised $270 million. That was terrible. But history's handful. Worthwhile member of a worthwhile group. People aspired to be history's handful because I was going to be a part of a group that was going to change history. And there were people that stepped up to do that. So look for ways to create community. Number seven, people like to be sought out for their opinion. Ask people what they think. This is a very non-threatening, I think, non-threatening question that you could ask people. How do you feel about the communication you receive from the Luis Palau Association? That's a little impersonal, right? I mean, it's not like, how do you feel about me? Or how do you feel about the ministry? How do you feel about the communication? But ask about the communication and it might unlock information about the ministry. And you can ask about the ministry. It's like, of all the things that we do, what would you like to see LPA do more of? What would you like to see LPA do less of? Wow, that's valuable. That's also helping you now customize your conversation with this person. They may love the stuff that you're doing for youth and they can't stand the pastor training thing that you're doing. Well, ask questions. Ask for their opinions. Number eight. People like to give for future plans. So the action is you need to plan. One of the things that I have, I know for sure is when a festival is over, it is over. If you think you're going to try to raise money for your evangelistic initiative after it's done, I'll pray for you. But it's not going to be easy. And we've been there, sadly, many times over the years. This might be breaking news to you, but like every time Luis Palau gets invited to do a festival somewhere, the budget doesn't always come in. What happens then? We pay for it. Okay? We find a way. We don't leave cities behind with deficits and the evangelist hightails it out of there and everybody's looking at each other and saying, who's going to pay these bills? That's not good. But the local budget doesn't always come in. So people like to give for future plans. So post-festival is not a future plan. That's a past thing. Debt, very hard to raise money for. Can be done. At my church, 20 years ago, Greater Portland Bible Church, we retired a debt on a building. And the way we did it was we linked it to the ministry that was going to enable us to do. If we got this interest payment like off the books, we could take that money then and deploy that into all the different direct ministries of the church. So you can try to raise money for debt, but preferably just raise the money before the thing happens. People give for future plans. And then the linked thing is the past gives credibility but doesn't motivate current gifts. And so, same point, basically, focus on the future. And, you know, that's interesting for the Luis Palau Association right now. You know, this past year we had a book on Luis's life. That's past. We had a movie about Luis's life. That's past. Those things are past. So we're talking about an exciting future right now. Though, there is a lot of, and here's the thing about these principles, they all interconnect. So all these things that I'm giving you, they all kind of weave together, okay? So people like to give for future, but people give to people, justified by the cause. So we have seen, since Luis's cancer diagnosis, I think a lot of people wanting to give gifts because they love Luis. And they want to encourage Luis, like in this season. And so, like the fundraising events that we've done in Portland, those dinners the last couple years, like Luis has come to that. And I think we've had a good combination of past history, but we've also had future. And the past does give credibility. This is where, you know, it gets out of the kind of the fantasy asks that, you know, you might be thinking about. Like, if you're saying, hey, we're going to do, I don't know, I can't really describe an example, but like some massive, you know, you're going to evangelize every top 50 city in the United States in the next 6 months. And the biggest thing that you've ever done is a high school assembly. That's, donors are going to have a hard time thinking that you have the organizational oomph to be able to deliver on what your vision is describing. So past history, I think, is important, and you need to use that, but don't lead with it. Like, your past doesn't inspire. It's good, but it's not going to drive future giving. So think about the future. Number 10, we get to flip the sheet over. And I got to go to this one. Are we at 45 minutes already? And I'm just getting to the backside? Whoa, okay. The more specific you are, the more believable you are. Share specific stories of real people. This is that point, you know, stats have a place, but stories win. Okay, when in doubt, go with it. If you only have one shot, I'd tell a story. Here's a formula for you. E minus I equals zero. E minus I equals zero. Everything minus integrity equals nothing. You have to tell real stories of real change lives, and not make them up, not over glorify them. We need to be honest in our development communication. Interesting details in letters and stories, I think, are winning. Not loaded with detail and losing people's attention, but little details. And one of the things that we, Luis always would say time and time again, is like the testimonies we got from the UK are always very detailed. Like when people would write to Luis and say, here's what happened. And they would go into great detail about like what was happening in the arena and what he said and all this stuff. And I mean, those are engaging. So specifics help people believe in what you're sharing, and that can come down to the amount that you're trying to raise, you know. So having a specific goal, you know, for a project, not some sort of rainbow, but like get specific about what you're trying to accomplish. In a given population, the distribution of wealth is unequal. Ask people at their level. We started to have that conversation earlier. It's like, well, how do you know like what their level is? This is why we have to spend time with our donors too and get to know them and test. And it's a process. It's not a hit and run. This is about relationships for the long haul. There's a lot of technology available today to personalize your communication and to customize your communication with people. Like, we should definitely be doing that. The age of like the dear friend letter to everybody asking for one amount for the entire group, we should be doing specific asks for that. We, like when we do our mailings, and we do a lot of mailings, like we mail to our friends every month. And when we suggest some amounts for them to consider investing, we base that on their largest single gift in the last 18 months. And we'll ask them, we'll give you the sort of like the basic formula, but like we'll, the first suggested amount that we'll put in front of them will be about 25% higher than their largest single gift. The second amount would be their largest single gift. And the third might be a little bit up or down off the first one. So we're trying to get people to lift their sights. We're asking them based on what their most significant gift has been in the last 18 months. So that's how we apply that to broad donors. Question, Al?
In your communications with people, can you talk about the effectiveness of mailings versus digital communication versus phone calls versus visits?
I would say to all of them, yes. And it definitely is not a one, you know, you just do one. I'm a real believer in what the industry people would say, integrated communication. And there are different strokes for different folks. Have you noticed that in your life? Have you noticed that with your kids? Okay. My kids do not do the telephone very well. You know, though when we get them, the telephone is a much richer form of communication than an email or a text. And so I believe in all the above. And I think the traditional direct mail, until people prove me wrong, and I'm sure there are exceptions to this, but the social media, the online, the website, and those things are good at informing, but it's many times it's the letter that actually gets the gift in the door. That people, and then flip side, people receive a letter will sometimes just go online to actually fulfill the gift. So the number of online transactions at Palau is growing, but not exponentially growing. And we've got a lot to learn, and we're actually looking to beef up our team to kind of do more in that world. Karen and I, because we were on staff with crew, we have, I bet you we get around November, December, maybe about 20 prayer letters from Campus Crusade for Christ staff. All of them are putting forward some kind of a financial opportunity at your end, right? We all have missionaries, blah, 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 in our world. This is a few years ago. We get 20 letters. One guy, Mike Fox, sent the letter, but he picked up the phone and he called us. And he said, "Hey, John and Karen, how's the family? Here's what's going on in my world. I have an opportunity to go do ministry somewhere. I need $2,500 or whatever, you know, his year-end need was. I was hoping you guys would consider having a part in that." Guess who got 100% of our year-end Campus Crusade gift that year? Mike Fox. Why? He picked up the phone and he called us. Uh-oh. That means work. In December, we make lots of phone calls at Palau. Luis last Christmas with cancer let me come over to his house with a list, and we called donors in December. So many different media. There's not one single bullet, and it's understanding your donors. And I believe in like all the above. So we tend to do the letter, and we try to anticipate when the letter's going to arrive, and then we would send the email about 2 or 3 days after the letter's in home. And that part we haven't really tested very well to know what would work better. Email first, then letter, or letter first, then email. But we're gonna communicate with both means. And trust the Lord's going to somehow use it to help people. Number 12. The more often a donor gives, for some reason doesn't want to show us. Ask donors for multiple gifts. The more often a donor gives, the more money they will give. Ask for multiple gifts. The good question that was asked earlier about the pastor church planting, I'm going to answer it slightly different now for what I would call mass donors. People that give through direct mail on the smaller end. I know of groups that would say, oh, that guy just gave, don't write to them. And in our experience, the people that gave the most recently are the most inclined to give again. There are chronic donors that literally every time we write to them from Palau, they're going to write a check to LPA. That's one of the reasons why we send a receipt immediately, within 48 hours of when it hits the door. We say thank you right now. And some of those people turn those receipts right around. We have people that give definitely over 20 gifts a year to LPA. And it's also the strength of having partner programs of people that make a commitment to give every month. So people who give consistently, or the more often a donor gives, the more money they will give. And then I'll get to this other one in a sec. Is existing donors give more than new donors? So work to keep your donors. That's where the appreciation comes in, genuine. That's where achievement comes in, showing the donors what their gifts have achieved. And the three mantra words for me and my team in development is win, keep, and lift. Win new donors, keep existing donors, and lift donors to new levels of involvement. Everything that we do in the development department has to do with win, keeping, and lifting. And keeping is a place where you need to really invest time. It'd be great if you had a way, and you can do this through technology, of seeing when you have people that are about to go 12 months since their last gift. And you want to intervene in the relationship proactively before they hit the 12-month mark. And that could be a series of mailings, phone calls, emails, but invite them to stay with you. So that's when we do broad-based phoning at Palau, especially at the end of the year, I am making sure that we're calling everybody who gave to LPA last year who has not yet given to LPA this year. And I'm using the phone as another mechanism. Phone's getting harder than ever, right? Robocalls. Who even answers their phone, So if they see it's from Luis Palau Association and they have a warm feeling about LPA, they might answer it, maybe. But if you have a warm conversation with someone, the percent response on phone calls is probably 20 to 30%, and maybe even higher with active donors. Clark?
Yeah. John, so most of us are not at your level as far as the supporting income, but you have people that are giving on a monthly basis. You are sending a letter to, as soon as you get that gift, saying, hey, thank you for this, sharing a little testimony in there. How often would a phone call, a touch point, be important?
How often should you phone your monthly partners is the question. More than once a year, I would say, more than once a year. Though, it just depends on what your capacity is to make those phone calls, but I would say two or three times a year would be great. And the other thing about monthly partners is they can still give to other stuff too. And so ideally, if we're doing everything right at Palau, we're going to invite people, even the monthly partners, to consider giving a special gift to a project once or twice a year. So the one phone call could just be a total affirmation. One could be, or maybe kind of presenting vision for something that you're doing later in the year. Another call could be, hey, remember that thing we talked about the last time? What's actually happening now? And I'm so grateful for your monthly support. You may or may not be in a position to help, but may, you know, we're looking, we need X dollars, and we were just wondering if you'd be in a position to do a special gift to help us with that. And then the final, you know, year-end call is just, it's all family, warmth, you know, so grateful. What are you guys doing at Christmas? You know, that's fun. And those are a lot of the calls that I'm doing with Luis at the end of the year. It's not asking, it's just saying thank you and connecting with people. Did I see a question in the back?
Yeah, the ministry is mostly maintained by smaller gifts that are consistent coming in every month. But we would have one or two people who perhaps are millionaires and who are getting $500 a month. How to hold a conversation to see if we can secure their commitment to a more significant amount of money?
Okay. How do you have that conversation with the larger donor, you know, someone that's maybe giving at a high level? If you want to invest an hour and 15 minutes tomorrow, I'll be right in the same room talking about major donors. So we're going to go for an hour and 15 minutes. I hope it won't be me just talking at you, and we'll have a little more dialogue in that one. But go visit them and get to know them. And then, you know, not on the first visit, just kind of get to know their heart, what they love about the ministry now, and then didn't let them know, I'd love to be able to bring you some bigger vision, you know, from time to time, and just keep you up on, you know, you've got a consequential investment in our ministry. Could we get together once in a while? I'd love to just keep you up to date on things. And then on one of those future visits, present a larger vision for them to consider. So that's a short answer on that one. So again, we're kind of in that same zone of monthly. People who give consistently give more to those who give sporadically. Encourage regular giving. It's a two-step process in the way I do it, though I bet you there are others that just go right for the electronic, or maybe electronic is the only option they offer. But we have a monthly partner program. It's called Reaching Your World Partners. And so we try to enlist people's monthly partnership first. And then as soon as they become a monthly partner, we work very hard to get them to move to electronic as the mode through which they're going to give that gift. I went through a phase where I thought the electronic thing kind of was sort of, not unspiritual, but just sort of like took the joy out of it for people. But let's just face it, like electronic bill pay and all this stuff is just how we function and live. And the most powerful thing for ministries in getting people to move to electronic is electronic doesn't forget. Electronic doesn't go on vacation, doesn't have mail mess ups, although there can be electronic mess ups. Credit cards, you have to get updated and things, so that's something that we have to stay diligent on. But people have an intention to give 12 gifts, and if they're electronic, they're probably going to give 12 gifts, whereas people that have an intention to give 12, but they got to write 12 checks, you might get 10. So your continuity rate is much higher if you can move people to electronic. So getting people to give consistently. Question?
Obviously the goal is build sincere relationship, and then the giving is going to come out as a fruit of that. So the communications have to be more than just constant appeals.
Right.
But what are some of the warning signs you might look for to see that maybe you're asking too often?
That's a good question. I don't know of any sort of like scientific way to like know just based on the giving behavior, other than and here's the thing that's really makes our job hard is many times donors won't tell us when they're unhappy. They're just going to disappear. In fact, the sad thing is, as we're sitting in this room right now, some of our donors are leaving. sad but true. So I don't, I mean, the key would be spend time with them. You know, I mean, you can only spend time with so many, so I'm going to say spend time with the people that are involved in the most consequential way, just to steward your time well. But, you know, that's where that question that I threw out earlier, how do you feel about the communication you're getting from LPA? That would be a good question to ask people from time to time. And, but do it per, you know, like, ideally, like if you could do it in a richer form, like face to face or by phone, I think that would be better. But a lot of times donors won't tell you if they're unhappy, you know, too. So it's tricky. But yeah, look at the mix. In fact, you're leading, I think I've got a point on that coming up here. People who give to more than one program and cause within an organization will give more and stay longer. And they're giving to the organization, they'll probably give more to each cause. That was something we researched heavily at Campus Crusade back in the day. But they had like support, you know, staff support donors that only were giving for the support of Karen Johnson, Springfield, Missouri. But if that same donor gave to Karen Johnson, Springfield, Missouri, and also gave to campus ministry at Missouri State University, those donors tended to stay longer and give more. And so the point would be to give people a challenge once in a while to consider giving to other kind of divisions within your organization. Getting variety from donors is good.
Could you go back for just one second?
Sure. Do you need what it said?
Yeah.
People who give to more than one cause. So the blank is cause. Because you have many causes within your organization. You might do, you know, at Palau, we do city gospel movements, and we help encourage young evangelists, and we have festivals, and we have a radio program. There's tons of different causes within LPA that we can invite people to give to. So getting people to give to more than one is a positive. People expect to be thanked for their contributions. Say thank you. 9 out of 10 lepers do not say thank you. Many times, many ways. The challenge, thank before you bank. Send the thank you before you bank the gift. And there's a chance, like someone that gave a gift to LPA, I could see them getting at least a half a dozen thank yous. Not always. But at LPA, I get an email every day from Shantae that has a list of every single gift that came to LPA, every one of them. And Luis gets it, and Andrew gets it, and Kevin gets it. And so we can see when our friends are stepping out. And so there's a machine-generated thank you with a, you know, letter that's a nice letter, but it's got a like lasered signature on it, and it tends to be in Kevin's name. And it talks about what's going on with the ministry, and it says thank you, and then there's the little receipt that goes out with it, with a reply envelope and a thing they can tear off to send back. But it used to be Luis, and now it's Andrew. So about every 3 weeks or so, Andrew will send a personal letter on his own, kind of like executive, cool stationery, saying thank you, and, you know, kind of reaffirming it. And then, well, I'm the vice president of development, and I know almost all these people. And so I will sometimes write a note on the actual receipt itself. Keith always writes little post-it notes, like Keith, who I work with, but I like to write it right on the receipt. Why? Because when they go to do their taxes in April, they see my handwritten thank you note on the little form, you know, just kind of like, okay, just write it right on the receipt, not over top of the receipt, but just on a spot there. So I might call. We have regional field representatives that build relationships with people. Well, if they see that there's one of their people gave, they might write a handwritten note, they might call, they might text, they might email. There might be a project where there would be someone that oversees the project that would we would make aware of the gift, and that person might say thank you. Do you think that's bad? I think it's awesome. I think the more thanking, that just shows, hey, this gift was noticed, and these guys are really grateful for it. Luis sat down with our development team for about 20 minutes yesterday. And, you know, he just brought 60 years of wisdom, you know, to the team. And he basically just said, I just, like, go crazy on saying thank you. He was saying that. He was charging kind of us to do that, you know. Like, say thank you. And if you don't say thank you, and his illustration was like, if I wrote, you know, a gift, you know, a decent gift to somebody and they didn't say thank you, I'd wonder, well, was this gift really appreciated? I got my little missionary, you know, who's down in Argentina. When I send her that same amount, she goes nuts and thanks me. I think I'm going to send my next gift to the missionary in Argentina. Say thank you. All right, picking up the pace. Home stretch here. If people only hear from us when we need money, they are less likely to respond. Communicate with donors in many ways. So that gets to the question in the back. You know, reports, prayer requests, things like that, or praying for the donors. 80% of the money comes from 20% of the donors. At Palau, it's actually more like 90% comes from 10% of the donors. And that's just kind of what we deal with at LPA. I bet if you look at your file, you're going to see that 80% of your income is coming from 20% of your donors. And so make the most of your time because the days are evil. Steward your time well to make sure that you're investing in the relationships of those who God's put on their heart to give to your ministry in a consequential way. Number 19, deadlines move people to action. Got to hit the target there. So if you have a legitimate deadline, use it. Urgency is a major factor in fundraising. I mean, if you're, you know, you may have the most exciting like outreach opportunity on the planet, but if it's like in 15 months and you're not really making a case for why they need to give the money now, that's a more challenging thing. So we generally are asking our national database if they're going to help with an international campaign probably about 45 days prior to the festival. Is kind of like the sweet spot in that 30 to 45 days because we need their money and a lot of the bills come crashing in at the end. And then finally, it's a ministry to raise money from the rich. 1 Timothy 6, 17 through 19. I should also have it memorized, but I don't. Instruct those who are rich in this present world not to be conceited or to fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches, but on God who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. Instruct them to do good. Challenge them. Ask them to do good. To be rich in good works. To be generous and ready to share. Storing up for themselves the treasure of a good foundation for the future. We can't take it with us, but we can send it ahead. And then, so that they may take hold of that which is life indeed, or as the NIV says, life that is truly life. So I started with the real secret. People need to give. We need to ask often. And I'm closing with basically the same point. When we challenge people to take some of the wealth that God's entrusted to them, this is good. I'm holding my Bible. This is really a good shot here. We are helping them. We're helping them experience life. This is not getting them to do something that they don't want to do. Rather, this is unlocking life. And so we need to be bold about inviting people to invest in our ministries. How are we doing on time, Meredith? Are we...
About 4 minutes.
4 minutes for questions. Anything that anybody wants to ask? Yes?
What are your thoughts on like thank you gifts, like books and resources in exchange for laws and thank you return for them?
I caught him there in exchange for... Thank you gifts. How do I feel about like giving gifts to donors, like kind of to say thank you? I am a fan of it if it is aligned with the ministry and it just kind of makes sense. I am not a fan of just sending stuff. Okay, so like we have team members that write books and things like that. So I love to provide books, you know, that are going to like minister to their life, something that, that God could use to help them grow. I'm not as big on trinkets, though like every Christmas for like the last probably 10 years, we've been sending a Christmas gift from like Luis and Pat to some of our major donors for probably, you know, the whole time I've been on the team. But there's a friend of ours who has this company that does these willow tree angels. They're carved angels. Okay, she knows what I'm talking about. They're kind of like a folk sort of style or whatever. Pat Palau likes them, so that's like key. You know, if it's something that the president doesn't like, then don't do it. It has to fit their personality. It has to fit your organization's personality. But we were able to get a quantity of those, and we send those to some of our people. And it is shocking how much people look forward to that. We had Ann Schofield, who works with me. You know, she kind of manages this whole process. It's pretty involved. And there was a guy or a couple, and the wife passed away. And so she took him off the Christmas ornament thing because it's a little girly, you know, the willow tree. It's sort of this thing. And he called and said, kind of hem-ha, you know, I didn't get an angel this year. Whoa, shocker. So, you know, if you do something consistently, then you need to kind of like, be careful on how you migrate off of it, and we got to figure out how to get off of these angels. We're going to do them again this year. But anyway, that's the one thing that we do that sort of like, it's the angel usually has some kind of a theme to it, so, you know, we maybe could weave that into the Christmas card, or I don't know, that we try. But things that are linked, that are going to bless them sincerely, and that are aligned with your ministry, I'm a fan of those. But I'm not a fan of just junky stuff. What else? Yes?
You might have already answered this, but how do you... There's a difference between a donor and a giver.
Yeah.
And how do you get those that are giving to be donors? Like say, you know, someone sees your ministry and they're like, oh, I'll give $50. And they know about your ministry, but how do you strategically get them to be more involved instead of just being givers, but being donors?
Yeah. So how do you move somebody kind of in their donor status with you from like, you know, like, yeah, a lot of groups like won't even call like a one-time donor a donor. That's sort of like, I'm not sure what category that is, but they're not really a regular partner. I think you just better be a great steward over that relationship and the first gift. And so helping them understand how you value it, what the gift accomplished. And then, you know, if you have the ability to kind of get them to come to something, to see the ministry up close. If you have events, you know, some of us have like donor gatherings or events, if you can get them to come to that. And then don't let too much time go by without giving them a second invitation to give. And generally speaking, if whatever got them to give is something that is an ongoing part of your ministry, invite their second gift for the same cause as the first gift, because that's what got them to engage. And, you know, once you've got two or three gifts, now you can start going for sort of something different in variety. But those would be a few thoughts on that.